It is the plum blossoms that bring the spring. Once this idea is accepted, spring must be everywhere. What idea? Here we are in the spring, sitting under the blossoms of that tree outside, that beautiful pinky, purpley, cherry apple something tree, with all of its blossoms beginning to fall down to the grass, so short-lived and so beautiful. So it's an interesting statement that it is the plum blossoms, it is the cherry blossoms that bring the spring. I think the more scientifically oriented among us might say that actually it has to do with the period of daylight and we get into all kinds of discussions about first causes if we wanted. And clearly the author is aware of this, that we would approach this idea differently often. We might say it is spring that brings the plum blossoms. And when we say spring, we might think we know what we mean. So this inversion, this interesting inversion, inviting us to consider cause-effect. What is it that brings what? What is spring anyway? When I use that word, what am I actually talking about? Maybe when we begin to look a little bit more deeply, we begin to see that the plum blossoms are the spring. They are not separate at all. Along with longer days and warmer days, or early in the spring, perhaps sleet on marathon day, is spring. And of course, if our happiness depends on spring manifesting in a particular way, we may only get one or two days of happiness. Because especially in Boston, it's summer before you know it. What if spring is not separate from the sleet? What if happiness is not separate from the sleet? This might be a different kind of happiness. The happiness that is okay with disappointment. This is the entryway to non-duality. This possibility that spring is not separate from anything. Spring is not separate from the cherry blossom. Neither causes the other. They are one. Happiness is not separate from your life, whatever manifestation it may take in any given moment. It is your life. And of course, this doesn't mean that we need to give up our aspirations in any way. Those too are our lives. Whatever arises, no matter the form, is you, is spring. Our mind isn't quite used to working this way. I said some time ago I was going to give a little talk about forms. Tonight I thought I'd talk a little bit about the Soto aspect of our tradition. Our lineage is of three different origins, two of which are Soto, one of which is Rinzai, actually technically Linji. So one traditionally has more of an emphasis on the koan tradition and on activity. And the other is very much about forms. We might say that one emphasizes a sudden awakening and the other emphasizes gradual cultivation. Of course, these are just ideas. They aren't really separate. But this one side of our tradition is the Soto side that I wanted to talk about tonight, where there is a real emphasis on attention to forms of practice. These forms of practice, for those who are new, can often feel quite strange. The idea of bowing as we enter the space, bowing before we sit, bowing out to the group, taking our seat, at the end of the evening, bowing to the Buddha, all of these things perhaps feel strange. Another one that can often feel really strange for folks who are new is the idea that we are not actually looking at each other as we sit in our meditation. And that as we walk during meditation, that we are not looking at each other. Not in the face anyway, just looking at shoulders and backs. We often joke at the end of a retreat that we know each other's feet very well. And that we've actually become quite intimate, but not in the normal way. And so many of these things can feel quite unusual and strange, and we kind of live our way into them if we continue with them. But they have purpose. So this bow as we enter the Zendo is a call to wake up. It's not that this space is actually any different from the rest of the room. Yet we bow as we enter, here I am entering into practice. I'm marking this moment in time, not a physical space so much, as this moment in time as I enter into practice. I give my heart to what I'm doing right here, right now. We bow to our cushion. And now I'm going to share with you a little bit of what some of these forms have come to mean to me. But this is not in any way an exhaustive description. For each of us, of course, they bring up different things. At some times, these things bring up resistance, which is always interesting to witness. We bow to our cushion. This is like bowing to the earth, which supports us as we sit. A remarkable thing. I think I've mentioned this story before, but Buddha challenged by the demon, if you will, of delusion, of Mara, of confusion and self-doubt and all of these concerns that entered into his mind over the course of the evening as he's meditating under the Bodhi tree just before his enlightenment, challenges him. And Buddha was, saying, "What makes you think you deserve this?" Or there are different stories that are told, but that's one version. And he just reaches down and touches the ground. The earth is my witness. All of us supported by the vastness of the earth. Quite a remarkable thing. All of us breathing the atmosphere. Buddha pointing to something significantly bigger than himself. What makes you think you deserve this? The fact that everything is. He just touches the earth. It's not about him anymore, is it? Something bigger than himself, supporting his practice. And so we bow to our cushion, something bigger than ourselves, supporting our practice. And we turn out to the group in recognition of our community, the other people, who also support our practice with their stillness, who don't force us to engage in pleasantries and small talk by looking at us in the eyes. It seems at first like a forced separateness, and yet as we come to practice, we may begin to find some relief in it. There's no obligation here outside of to one another and our practice, but not in a sort of social way. It relieves us of that burden. We bow out to each other for supporting one another in our practice, for being part of a sangha together, part of a community of practitioners. And people bow back. And we take our seat. And in taking our seat, we find ourselves sitting upright. The posture. Each of us physically capable of very different things. So some sitting in chairs. There are even people who sit lying down. But for those due to back injuries or things like that. But for those people, there are forms, right, that are even involved in that. And what these forms do is they allow us to rest in a kind of routine, in a sense. That means we don't have to think about what we are doing. It doesn't have to, of course, we do it first as we're learning the forms. But eventually the forms become something reliable for us. We come to know them in an intimate way, and we know that we can just sink right into them, that they hold us. So we sit upright. This is our way of we enter into stillness here. This non-activity, this stillness, becomes a means for us to, for the moment, stop chasing after things. Stop chasing after desires. Stop running away from things. To simply be still and meet our lives and ourselves exactly as we are. So often we are on the hunt. And this stillness is an incredible gift. Something that at first we may not even treasure very much. We may find it confusing and find thoughts running through that are telling us to do other things. As we eventually bow to one another to mark the end of the period, an incredible thing that we have a timekeeper. We don't have to worry about time. The light blinks, the timekeeper rings the bell. We can completely entrust our practice to something bigger than ourselves. We follow out of the zendo, we take steps in the footsteps of those in front of us. We walk as one. This allows us to give ourselves entirely to the practice of walking, to feel each step of our foot on the ground. So often we walk to get somewhere. We walk to arrive at a different place, and we forget that we are even walking. In this practice, we are not looking to get anywhere at all. That's the majesty of this practice. Quite remarkable, really. I remember when I first started walking meditation, first of all, I thought it was a cult. Secondly, I thought, what is the purpose of this? We're not going anywhere at all. This is so weird. That's how I felt about it. So I began to wonder about the purposes of these forms. And of course, in doing so, of course, I'm creating a dualistic story about something that I'll attain in the future if I continue to do this practice of walking. If I continue to sit in this posture, if I continue to walk, I will achieve something other than what I am. And of course, we continue to practice and practice and practice until we realize that is actually not quite what happens. The practice is constantly reorienting us toward what we already are so that we can appreciate life just as it is, so we can learn to do so. Because the powerful habit mind of seeking things outside of ourselves is strong. And these forms, we actually kind of need them to wake up, to return, to be here now in our bodies. So in fact, much like the plum blossoms in the spring, awakening is not separate from the forms. The forms are not actually in service of some future awakening. They are awakening itself in the form of a foot touching the ground, in the form of sitting up tall and dignified and receiving whatever is here, perhaps a worried mind, perhaps disagreement and anger and frustration, embarrassment, joy, the sweet scent of a plum blossom, whatever may be here. This is an opportunity for ideas about what is here to just disintegrate right into the aliveness of the moment itself in the form of sitting on a cushion, in the form of a painful back, in the form of feet touching the ground, in the form of a droning fan or a droning voice. Whatever is. We learn through these forms, which hold our feet to the fire in a deep way, to accept what is here. To stop running away and stop chasing. And simply be awake. Of course, that sounds so easy, but all of us know that life has powerful kind of karmic habit energies. These in and of themselves are not bad, but we need to be awake to them. And these forms really help us do that. And we have talks or interviews, and each of those has its own form where perhaps you come in to see the teacher, sometimes me, sometimes someone else. And we bow at the door, and then we bow before the cushion, and we sit, and we say, you know, we've met with this teacher 486 times before, and we walk in and we say, my name is Mike, and my practice is. Because it allows us, yet again, to forget ourselves. It's quite paradoxical, isn't it? You don't need to come in and create yourself at the beginning of an interview. I need to present this version of myself to the teacher. You simply show up and trust that, like the lungs breathe, the cells of the body metabolize and do their work. The sun continues to shine. So too you. Nothing needs to be forced. The forms can hold everything. And we bow at the end of the interview, and turn and the bell rings and all these systems at work supporting our practice come back in, bow at our cushion, bow out. And in the end of the evening, we chant. We have our four vows. Chanting is a remarkable form in and of itself. I noticed we had our varsity players showed up on the instruments tonight. Nobody making mistakes. Everybody really on top of their game. And of course, we all go from, you know, varsity to JV in a heartbeat. And then back up. Mistakes, no mistakes. It doesn't really matter. But the bells ringing in these places that indicate what we are to do next. If you really pay attention, and by the way, an invitation for anyone who's interested in learning to play any of the instruments, just come early. Come early next week. Show up 15 minutes early. We'll have a class on how to play instruments so that everyone has the opportunity to play them. They're such a beautiful practice, learning to make the bells sing. They really demand our attention. These little black circles at the end of a line indicating a bell rings or a diamond indicating the striking of the mukugyo. And we all just follow along. Even the instrumentalists are really just following along. Even the chant leader following along. It's the plum blossoms that bring the spring. Where is the line between cause and effect? Where is the line between me and you? And in the end of the evening, our final bows. These bows are a deep practice, anyone who's not physically able to do them is fine. Nobody has to do them. But the bows in the end of the evening, we go all the way to the ground. And as we get to the ground, we lift our hands up over our head. There's a story of Shunryu Suzuki's teacher who used to have a little welt on his forehead from bowing so much. And he was asked, "Why do you bow so much, dear teacher?" He said, "Because I am a stubborn man." There's a kind of surrendering in bowing. We aren't bowing to some god or a Buddha outside of ourselves. Again, this is a non-dualistic practice. We may not feel that at first. It may seem like the bows are something to something outside of us. But they are actually to the fullness of our lives in the given moment, to the universe manifesting, to the earth holding us up. It's quite an amazing thing to touch your forehead to the ground, which holds you up, and to give thanks. This appreciatory moment of physically expressing our gratitude for things the way they are. Those of us who have sat for some time have certainly encountered that moment where at first something appeared and we thought it was horrible. Perhaps it was worry or anxiety or sadness, and we kept sitting with it, and it showed its face to us, and the more that we let it in, the more we experienced something beautiful and sweet in it. Not because we were thinking about it, but because we were encountering it in a kind of fullness of its presentation. Manifestation shining in our bodies. Maybe tears. Awake with things the way they are. What a gift, what a precious gift this practice is. And all the forms working together to allow that separateness to fall away, to allow us to be completely one with each form, the form of you.